This is unprecedented. High schools will have to give name, address, phone number to military recruiters.
We have to find our voices and shout about this. We have to remind our fellow Americans what the bedrock principles are of our American democracy, of our Constitution.
Now I wake up in the morning and I say to myself, who do I hate today? And that's the way you write a column.
If Iraq had broccoli underneath their ground, we wouldn't be bombing them. But they got the oil, and that's where power is.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, November 21st, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Speaking to British members of Parliament Wednesday night, President Bush's top security adviser, Richard Perle, stated that the U.S. plans to launch an attack against Iraq even if UN inspectors fail to find weapons. He went on to say that evidence from even one member of the Iraqi weapons program would be enough to trigger a war. Meanwhile, as the U.S. prepares to eventually lead ground troops into Iraq, the military is searching for new ways to recruit servicemen and women. One solution has come up with a provision that was included in the recent No Child Left Behind Act, recently passed by Congress. Though the main thrust of the law is to increase educational opportunities for elementary and secondary school students, a little-known requirement will mandate that high schools provide the names, addresses, and personal telephone numbers of students to military recruiters. We spoke with David Goodman, whose article, No Child Unrecruited, appears in the current edition of Mother Jones magazine.
This is unprecedented. The law that you're speaking of, the No Child Left Behind Act, was passed earlier this year by President Bush. It is his signature education reform policy. It's received a lot of media attention for its focus on getting students and schools to achieve certain standards, and probably most controversially until now has been the requirement that there will be annual school testing and things like that. But it's gone pretty much unnoticed.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a stealth clause in all this.
That's right. The clause on military recruiters was slipped into this. And this law is 670 pages long. Hmm. So it wasn't difficult to bury deep within it, special interest provisions. But this one does take things to new levels. What the No Child Left Behind Act now requires is, for the first time, high schools, and it's actually public and private high schools that are going to be required to do this, will have to give what's called directory information, and that's name, address, phone number, even if the family number is unlisted, to military recruiters for the purpose of recruiters contacting students to get them to join the armed forces. The only way that you can avoid having this done is if you opt out. But now, opting out is sort of a tricky business. First, you have to know that your name is being sent to the military to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And second, you have to do something, pick up pen to paper and send something into the school to keep your name from being sent to recruiters. So the default provision with this law is that your kid's going to get recruited.
So can the parents opt their child out? I'm reading an article that quotes a recruiter, Major Johannes Perrin, who's head of the U.S. Army recruiter. He's rather the head U.S. Army recruiter for Vermont. And he says, quote, "The only thing that will get us to stop contacting the family is if they contact their congressman, or maybe if the kid died, we'll take them off the list," unquote.
That's right. For my article in Mother Jones, in the current issue, I spoke with Major Perrin, the head recruiter for New York and Vermont, and asked him, so let's say you make your call and the family or the student tells you, "I'm not interested, and don't call me anymore." And what he told me was, "We're not going to listen to that." And as the quote you just read indicates, unless you take fairly dramatic action, you're going to continue to get called. I should point out something, too, which is people are under a lot of misperceptions about what recruiting entails. it's a very aggressive business.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to say the best recruiters, in the way that they think of themselves, don't take no for an answer. And they're very creative about where and how they find your kids. They'll find them, you know, they'll be going to the malls, they'll be going to the ball games, they'll be going to the dances, anywhere that they can find students. And Major Perrin is only one recruiter. He's a recruiter for the Army. There are no less than six services that have full-time recruiting commands. That's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the Reserves.
Mm-hmm.
So you've just heard what one recruiter will do. And if you tell him to stop calling, that doesn't mean the guy from the Marines is going to stop calling.
So do they actually have access to the campuses where they can, under this new act, whereby they can go on the campus and try to lobby the kids?
That's right. The law also requires that schools grant physical access to the recruiters. Now, what this changes, this can, for some schools, this may change nothing. You know, we're schools where they have administrations that are very sympathetic to the military. Recruiters already have free access. They come and go. They have tables up in the lunchroom. So this really doesn't do a thing. But there's a number of schools, particularly in the East and the Northeast and, well, some of the larger urban centers, which have very restrictive policies about who can access the schools. The cities of San Francisco and Portland, Oregon, for example, bar access to any military recruiters because they have a district-wide anti-discrimination policy. And because the military discriminates against gays and lesbians, they are not allowed on campus. This law, the No Child Left Behind Act, will now overrule those local policies and force those schools to grant access and give information to the military, which they did not do prior to this.
And I think the egregious part about this act or this law is that if the schools don't comply, their consequences to pay.
They could very well be shut down. The consequences are that they would lose federal aid, and that's pretty much what shut down many, if not most, public schools. The other consequences of defying this law are that you will have, a defiant principal or superintendent would be visited by a uniformed military officer who would have a chat with them. If that didn't bring satisfaction, they would then probably be visited by a higher-up officer, and then ultimately the secretaries of defense and or education, the federal secretaries, would contact the governor of that state to come down on the intransigent school administrators.
They're quite serious about this, aren't they?
Well, and they're serious, and it's sort of curious that they are, because, in fact, for the last 2 years, the military has met or exceeded all of its recruiting quotas. So what really is going on here? Why are they forcing this down the throats of schools?
Iraq, maybe?
Oh, actually, this predates. The military has been trying to get greater access every single year, and they're routinely... I wouldn't say turned down, but most of their requests are rebuffed. But when I spoke to the sponsor of this bill, Representative David Vitter, a Republican from Louisiana, what he told me was that he cited the statistic that about 15% of the nation's 22,000 high schools were, quote, problem schools for recruiters. That means they didn't give complete free access to recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
And the other number they cite is that there have been over 19,000 occasions where recruiters have been denied access to a school. And he said, quote, this demonstrated an anti-military attitude that I thought was offensive. So what's really going on here is they're trying to, you know, stamp out any, you know, opposition at all that's expressed within a school setting towards the military having free access. Now, the military likes to say that all this is about is getting equal access to the schools. As one recruiter said to me, hey, we just want the same access to your kids that the class ring companies have. Well, the problem is the military has far greater access than any other organizations. They get to administer their own nationwide vocational aptitude test. Very often, as I mentioned before, they have tables within the school. And as I've written in Mother Jones previously, earlier this year, a feature about a junior ROTC, that's high school ROTC, There are 500,000 students in this country in 3,000 different high schools who are in military uniforms in courses that are that uniformed military teach. So I don't think there's really a problem here for access for the military.
And of course, there's a lot more at stake. But now, this is sort of like waving a red flag in front of civil libertarians, considering the Privacy Act. Any legal responses in the works?
So far, no. The civil libertarians have so far just been... I mean, first of all, I should point out in my research for this article, nobody even knew about this thing. I mean, I had to call high and low in both Departments of Defense and Education to find, and as I now joke, there's one guy in each place who knows about this law. And actually, there's been no other spokesperson they've been able to trot out to speak about this.
Mm-hmm.
When I talked to school administrators, some of them laughed at me when I asked them what was their policy. They said, what are you talking about? Forcing us to give names to the military. We would never do that. Well, it's just this month, as we speak, that administrators are finding out about this law in letters from either their local recruiters or from a letter sent by Rumsfeld and Page, the Secretaries of Defense and Education. So civil libertarians have been caught off guard, and it remains to be seen whether or not they are going to be able to mount a successful legal action.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll add, though, there is something that you can do. Unlike other stories which end with people who are concerned about it saying, write to your congressman, this law does have a built-in, Achilles heel, which is this opt-out provision. Now, for parents and students who are concerned, they need to first inquire within their school, are students being informed that their information is going to go to the military? So first that has to happen. And second, people who are concerned can organize a campaign within schools to campaign for a very high, educate people and campaign for a very high opt-out rate. Go to all the students and discuss with them what it means to go into the Army and this kind of thing.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, one might argue, what's the big deal? The kid can just say no.
A kid can just say no, but as we've been discussing about how these recruiters operate, just saying no doesn't stop them. That just means they'll call back in a week. And I asked some of the recruiters I spoke with why. Why don't they take no for an answer? And this fellow Major Perrin, the head recruiter in the Northeast here, said, my buddies right now are on the front lines in Afghanistan. He said, my front lines are in this recruiting office, and I'm going to pursue what I do just as aggressively here as they do in Afghanistan.
Mother Jones reporter David Goodman, author of Leave No Child Unrecruited. The anti-war message is hitting close to home for the president. Code Pink is in effect as women peace activists with the anti-war group are conducting a fast in front of the White House. Reem Kadhuda, Pacifica's Peace Watch correspondent for WPFW, talked today with a couple of these women camped out at Lafayette Park across from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue since Sunday. She spoke with Nancy Caulfield from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Diane Wilson, a known activist from Texas.
I'm fasting. I have to do something. I am so disgusted with what's happening in our country. And the fact that we may be going to war with Iraq, we may be killing innocent people, I don't want them to do that in my name, and I want to fast as an offering in a spiritual way, as a prayer almost, declaring that this is very serious to me. I'm very sure that I don't want what's happening with our government.
How long you've been fasting?
I started fasting last Sunday. I'll only be here until next Sunday, and I'm going to fast for the time that I'm here.
How you're fasting?
Water only, day and night.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling really great right now. The first 3 days are really hard, but then after the third day, you start feeling really good for a while. Diane probably will end up maybe not feeling so well after 30 days or so.
One big challenge is when you stop eating, your body's ways of generating heat decreases. Are you cold? How's that?
I don't feel cold right now, but it is a problem with fasting, and we're very concerned and want to make sure that we keep Diane safe and warm for the whole 40 days.
In Utah, do people know what's going on here with you? How are you using your fast to maybe also inform them?
When I go back to Utah, I'm going to start organizing in my state as well. And we hope that women will organize in every state. We want to build a women's movement, not just against the war, but to say we want the money that you're spending on war and arms and the military to be spent on things that we need at home, like education, housing, food for the poor, programs for the homeless. There are so many things that we need at home that we can't have, but we can spend $200 billion on a war. This is the famous Diane Wilson.
Hi, Diane.
She's done several fasts, and she has protested against the petrochemical industry along the Gulf Coast in Texas. She's from Texas. She's a shrimper, fourth generation shrimper, and she has been protesting against the pollution of the waters there for years and has done some very fine acts of resistance. And now she's decided to take on this administration, and she's doing a 40-day fast here, and also maybe prior to that has done some other actions.
How are you feeling today, Diane?
I'm feeling okay. I'm just cold. She's from Salt Lake City, Utah, and is used to the cold weather, and my blood is real thin. When I left home, it was 85 degrees, so I'm cold. I've been cold. I've been putting layers and layers on. Yeah, I think I'm in a blizzard down here.
Is it worth it?
Oh, it was definitely worth it. It's the fundamental bottom line down here is you have a country go to war, especially this war, and I feel like it will bring on more attacks like what happened in 9/11, and we'll have the blood of the Iraqi people on our hands. We've had a half a dozen people come by here, and they're obviously were for war, and they would say, we got to get Saddam Hussein. Get him. We don't have smart bombs that will just hit Saddam Hussein. What happens is you get all of these innocent people, these women and children and hospitals and infrastructures get knocked out. And it's like Osama bin Laden. We've been bombing the hell out of that place over there, and here he is, still alive. They still haven't got him. In the whole war with Iraq, I'm from Texas, and we got the entire oil refinery, the chemical plants up and down the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast. And I know about oil, and I know about what it does, impacts the communities, and how the corporations, the power that they hold, because they hold that kind of power in our counties, and they hold it right there across there in the White House. And quite frankly, I think the entire reason we're going to Iraq is that it is for the oil, you know, is if Iraq had broccoli underneath their ground, we wouldn't be bombing them. But they got the oil, and that's where power is. And it's wrong.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathouda.
The vigil is expected to last through March 8th, International Women's Day. She intends to terminate her fast at a peace rally. Peace groups are mobilizing for war in Minnesota, that is, to stop it, as President Bush seeks broad international support at the NATO summit to support a U.S.-led attack on Iraq. Anti-war groups in Minneapolis and St. Paul are training new recruits in the art of civil disobedience and nonviolent protest. Pacifica affiliate KFIA's James Kwan has this report.
The definition I like to use for civil disobedience is deliberately breaking a law to shed light upon an injustice. Does anyone else have...
Around a dozen people of various ages listened to civil disobedience techniques on Monday in a lecture hall at the U of M. The atmosphere is buoyant, with questions fired back and forth on legal questions and possible protest actions.
How many people have committed civil disobedience before? Put your hand up. Okay, most of us haven't. And what happens is that you're chanting and you have your support rally chanting with you and you're trying to get your message out and the cameras are all around waiting for the big arrest moment because the cops just told them it was about to happen because they always are buddy-buddy like that. And the officers, the arresting officers...
Jessica Sundin is a familiar face and voice in local anti-war organizing. She is a member of the Anti-War Committee, a group formed to protest the 1991 Gulf War. The group is holding civil disobedience training sessions for new volunteers on protest methods and legal issues. Organizers talk about what to do when getting arrested and potential penalties. The Anti-War Committee, with other peace groups, is planning major protest actions if a war is initiated in Iraq. Anti-War Committee's Nathan Paulson.
The consequences and the cost of this war is a really important reason why I personally am not the least bit afraid of spending a day in jail or 3 months in jail or whatever it may be at all. I really don't care. And the reason is we're talking about dropping tons of bombs over Iraq. And we know that those bombs aren't just going to be landing at the doorstep of Saddam Hussein's little palace or wherever the hell he's going to be.
And it's not only the Anti-War Committee who are organizing. There are more than a dozen local peace groups in the Twin Cities. Many of the groups are working together. And with the possibility of war looking likely, organizers like Jennifer Randolph Riza from Women Against Military Madness says people are responding.
Well, I think there's been a shift starting probably just a few weeks before the election to, this is real. We really are going to go to war. We're not just posturing. And people are very afraid and feeling like it's time for them to act. And so we've seen our membership grow from about 1,300 to about 1,600 in just the past 2 months, which is an amazing growth for us. And I think it's only a tip of the iceberg of all the people out there who are concerned about this war.
The group WAM is seeing other signs of success. Along with organizing protests and informational meetings, the group is selling anti-war lawn signs. They've already sold well over 1,000 signs, with another 1,000 currently on order. Anti-War Committee volunteer Jared Cruz agrees people are noticing.
Actually, you know, talking to people on a daily basis, and our experience has been that in this community and the people we work with, the communities we outreach to, there's a broad sentiment against this war. And not only a broad sentiment against the war, but a very strong sentiment against the war. People are ready to speak out strongly. People are ready to take action.
WAM volunteer Deb Wilkins Costello has recently joined the anti-war movement. She says she joined the group because of concerns about how war might impact her 16-year-old son. Deb, who volunteers a half day a week, hopes her work will make a positive impact.
My work at WAM, my very short tenure at WAM at this point, I think does get people thinking about, you know, what can they do? There are things we can do other than just read the newspaper and get worrisome and concerned about what's coming.
If the U.S. goes to war in Iraq, Twin Cities peace groups have an emergency response plan. A demonstration will be held at the Federal Building in downtown Minneapolis at 4:30 p.m. on the day the war in Iraq is announced in the newspaper. WAM's Jen Risa says peace groups are ready, but hopes with a peaceful protest, alternatives to war are possible.
I think September 11th shocked this nation into realizing that we are vulnerable. But what it failed to do was to make us realize that we don't then want to cause this kind of grief to other people as well. Instead, we turned that fear into lashing out. And again, I think we can do better than that. That we can find real solutions instead of hitting back or even now hitting first.
With recent reports of the Bush administration laying the groundwork for war, Twin Cities peace groups are busy planning their response. A coalition of groups is sponsoring a public forum on December 7th to express arguments against a war in Iraq. Tonight, the Anti-War Committee is holding another civil disobedience training session at Mayday Books at 7 p.m. in Minneapolis. I'm James Kwan.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Last weekend, thousands of people gathered in Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, to protest the U.S. Army School of the Americas. Graduates of the school have been linked to numerous counts of human rights violations throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. While the U.S. expands its war on terror to Iraq, the protesters made the connection between terrorism abroad and terrorist training at home. Father Simon Herrick of Voices in the Wilderness spoke at the rally on Saturday.
The Miro Truth Tour has started up in New York City and has gone through over 100 campuses all over this country already, saying no to weapons of mass destruction that we create, no to weapons of mass destruction that spread terror throughout the world, and no to the terror that is being exercised in Iraq. When we bombed Iraq 12 years ago, we unleashed, because we destroyed their clean water delivery system, we destroyed their sewage treatment system, and we unleashed filthy water throughout Iraq. And we unleashed cholera, typhoid, dysentery, diphtheria, all the way through Iraq. And as a result of that, as a result of the sanctions, which prevent those diseases from being treated, which prevent the clean water delivery system from being repaired, as a result of that, the UN reported 3 years ago that 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five are now dead because of the sanctions we keep on Iraq. Does that represent us? Does that represent us? Does this represent us? Then I'm going to submit to your reflection this. Previous to this, we in the peace movement, I believe, have been working with the analysis of Martin Luther King. I suggest that we need to move away from that analysis to the analysis of another man. Another nonviolent man, Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi was working in a different circumstance. He was working with a power that was alien to his people. He was working to remove an alien power from governing the Indian people. And I submit to your reflection that because this government has already voted to cede war-making powers to the president, is no longer representing us. It doesn't represent us. It represents powers of weapons makers and oil manufacturers. It does not represent us. Inasmuch as they do not represent us, inasmuch as they pursue violence, inasmuch as they pursue greed, we must withdraw from them our consent so that they can no longer govern us. This is the analysis of Gandhi. The analysis of Gandhi calls for massive, non-violent, non-cooperation until, to quote our Declaration of Independence, this government, which no longer represents us, is either altered or abolished. I was asked at one of the places that I gave a speech, someone said to me, who's the most powerful person that you ever told these things about Iraq to? And what was their response? And I said to him, as far as I recall, we are still fighting to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so the most powerful person I have ever spoken these words to is you. We have to contemplate engaging now in tax resistance, in massive boycotts, in walkouts from your classes in school, so we can begin to demonstrate to this government that we have withdrawn our consent and they can no longer govern us until they truly represent our desires and wishes. The most powerful person I have ever spoken these words to is you. What will your reaction be?
Father Simon Herrick of Voices in the Wilderness. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.